just like we used to wear. If I can keep that picture in my mind, I don't think I'll forget what I'm looking for. But I haven't come across it yet, and I'm ready to drop. I dig into a square bin full of socks, sagging against the side, my arms lost in the fabric. An image of my mother battering a mass of clothes against the sides of a suitcase blinks into my head and is gone. I can't understand why it's so difficult to find a normal sweater. Helen and Katie sigh, and I wonder how long we've been walking around, how long we've been searching. I'm starting to regret this trip. It's a pity, because I used to love shopping. But the shops are so different now, everything jumbled together, jumbled about. So many odd colours. Who is it wears these bright orange things? They must look like road diggers. Young people will wear almost anything, it appears. Just look at Katie. Seems funny I should have a granddaughter with piercings, though I suppose she is considered quite unremarkable by other teenagers. Perhaps I would have piercings too, if I were young now. She leans on a rail of floral skirts, mimicking my own pose. Only Helen stays completely upright, standing in the middle of the lino path, forcing other shoppers to dodge past her. Mother, we've shown you 100 sweaters, she says. You've rejected them all. There are no more left to show you. Can't have been 100. I do get annoyed at Helen's exaggerations. What about over there? We haven't looked in that bit yet. I point to the other side of women's wear. Grandma, we've just come from there. Of course we have. Have we? Katie pushes herself away from the skirts, hooking a cream sweater off a rail next to her. Look, this one is nice. It's the right sort of colour. It's ribbed. No good. I shake my head. I can't understand it. All I want is a sweater with a round neck. Not a polo, not a V. Warm, but not too thick. Katie grins at her mother before turning to me. Yes, and it can't be too long, but mustn't be too short. Exactly. Half the sweaters don't even cover your belly button. And I know you're making fun, Katie, I say, although I only know after I've started to answer. But it's not much to ask, is it? A normal sweater? And a normal colour? Black or navy or beige or... Thank you, Katie, you may laugh. But you can't really expect me to wear one of these odd colours. Puce or magenta or teal or whatever they are. I can't help smiling. It's nice being teased. Elizabeth often teases me too. It makes me feel human. At least someone assumes I'm intelligent enough to get a joke. My granddaughter laughs, but Helen puts her hands up to her head, surveying the rails and rails of clothes. Mum, can't you see that to find a sweater that is the length, thickness, colour, neck type, and goodness knows what else that suits you personally is an impossible task? I don't see why. When I was young, I could always find the right sort of sweater. I had more choice in those days. What? During rationing? I doubt that. They did. Or at least you could always find someone to make you what you wanted. And Suki used to bring me beautiful clothes. My sister always dressed very stylishly, especially after she married. She cut things up and made them new, of course. But still, Ma used to wonder where she got the money, never mind the coupons. And Dad would shake his head, talking about the black market. I got a lovely velvet bolero from her once. I wore it far too often, for very ordinary occasions, and wished later that I'd saved it for best. I was wearing it the last time I saw her. She had come through the kitchen door while I was cutting the bread. I changed out of my school uniform into a dress and my bolero, but couldn't match my sister in her duck-egg blue suit and Lana Turner pin curls. She was 7 years older than me, and 10 times more sophisticated. "Hello, Maud," she said, kissing me on the top of my head. "Where's Ma?" "Putting on another cardigan. Dad's getting the fish and chips." Suki nodded and sat down at the table. I pushed the teapot into a beam of light, thinking that would keep it warm for a little longer. Our kitchen was usually dark until just before sundown, when the rays would make it through the gaps in the dense bramble hedge in the back garden. We used to time our evening meal to catch those last few moments of sunshine. "Is Douglas in?" Suki leaned forward a little to look down the hall towards the stairs as she spoke. "Is he sleeping here tonight?"
"Of course, why wouldn't he be?"
I laughed.
"He's our lodger. Sleeping here is what he pays for."
I looked up from my task of laying the cups out. Suki wasn't laughing. Her face was pale and she couldn't seem to keep still. She twisted the ring on her finger and spent an age arranging her jacket on the back of a chair.
"I thought I might stay," she said finally.
I must have realized I was staring because she suddenly smiled.
"Is that so odd? So wrong?"
She seemed to be genuinely asking.
"No," I said. "You can stay in my room. Your old bed's still there."
Ma came down the steps into the kitchen, greeting Suki and kissing her.
"Your dad'll be back with the fish in a minute," she said. "Have a cup of tea. Pour it, would you, Maud?"
"Thank you, Polly," Suki said, the way she always did if I made tea.
"Shall I make your bed up now?"
"Never mind, Mops," she said, her voice low. "I'll have to think about it first." I poured the tea, feeling like I'd missed something. Dad arrived and we laid the hot fish and chips out on plates, the stinging smell of vinegar rising on the steam. Suki seemed calmer now, but she dropped her teaspoon when Ma asked how Frank was.
"Well enough," she said. "He's going away this evening, taking a load up to London. They're packing the van up now, which is why he couldn't come. All these people moving back home."
Suki's husband had inherited his parents' furniture removal business and spent the war helping people move out of bombed buildings into new lodgings. Now he was helping them to go back where they'd come from.
"Perhaps you could come over for your dinner while he's away," Dad said. "Be nice to see you more often."
"Yeah, I could. Just while Frank's gone. It's such a big house, and it seems silly to eat on your own, doesn't it?"
"Sure does,"
Douglas called as he came into the kitchen.
He collected American phrases from the films and used them as often as possible. It was irritating, but both Ma and Suki had told me I mustn't mind because of him losing his mother in a night raid.
"How are you doing, Suki?"
he said, as he took his place at the table and began on his dinner.
"Fine, thanks, Doug."
We ate quickly, not wanting our chips to get cold. Dad told us about a change in his rounds since another worker had come home from the army, comparing his new postal routes with Douglas's milk rounds, and Ma complained about the queue at the butcher's.
I only half listened, distracted by Suki and then by Douglas. I couldn't help trying to anticipate where he would put in the next bit of American slang. It tended to come out strangely twisted by his Hampshire accent.
"I was thinking of going down to Tubb Street to the movies," he said when he'd finished eating.
He was looking at Suki, and the last of the light showed the places on his face where his stubble didn't yet join. There was a C-shaped patch of smooth pink skin on his cheek, and another under his chin.
"Bye, then," Suki said, opening her compact and pressing the puff to her nose.
She swiped it expertly across her forehead, reminding me of her promise to teach me how to use makeup. And Douglas watched her for a moment before going off to get his coat from the hall.
If only there was a kind of makeup for Douglas, I thought. A compact, with powder to fill in his beard.
When Ma got up to clear the dishes and Dad went to put the greasy newspaper in the outside bin, I leant towards Suki.
"Are you going to stay tonight?" I asked her.
I'd been thinking during dinner and had come up with several possible explanations. Has something happened between you and Frank? She shook her head. I told you, Mops. I need to think. In fact, I'd better be getting back now. Bye, Ma. Dad. See ya. She was nearly at the door before I remembered. I got you a gift, Suki. She smiled properly, genuinely, for the first time. It's for your hair, I said, spoiling the surprise slightly. I'd bought two matching combs on Saturday at Woolworths, one for her, one for me. They were fake tortoiseshell and covered with crudely moulded birds, but when I'd held them up to the light, the wings had almost seemed to flutter. It's beautiful. Thank you, darling, she said, opening the tissue paper and sliding the comb into a wave of hair above her ear. She kissed me before she slipped out the door, and I still had her lipstick on my forehead when Douglas came back from the pictures. He laughed as he smudged it off with his thumb. I remember thinking it was funny, because when he teased me about it, he mentioned the exact shade. Victory Red. Can I help? The girl at the makeup counter is dull against the lit-up glass, dressed in white, her face various shades of beige. All around her are golden see-through powder compacts, open like clams. What I need is the bottom half of a blue and silver one, but I won't find it here. I want some lipstick, I tell the girl. She nods and waves limply at a plastic display. Victory Red, I say. I'm sorry? I wanted Victory Red. The sweet, wet smell in these places is overwhelming. I feel like I'm breathing through molasses. Helen and Katie are trying on various perfumes a few feet away, making faces and coughing. They're looking for a gift for Carla, because she did something or didn't do something, or because I did something. The girl looks at the stand, pulling out several little tubes and replacing them roughly. They clack against the plastic. I don't think we do that one, she says. How about this? She holds up a shiny, squarish cylinder. The sticker on it says, Seductive Scarlet. Sounds promising. I take it from her and draw a streak over my hand, the colour seeping into the wrinkles. Yes, that's nice, I say, handing it back. But I'd prefer Victory Red. Do you have that? Sorry, we don't do that one. She smiles and slouches against the counter. There's a sour smell under the perfume that makes me think the shop uniforms are all nylon. Really? What a nuisance. Why's that? It's just a bit old-fashioned. Why not have this one instead? I want to ask Katie's opinion, but I can't see her. Or Helen. I walk past the other shining counters. No sign of them. The light drops as I move into another department full of glistening leather bags and cheap jewellery. The racks are over twice my height and crowded with goods, which reflects the spotlighting into my eyes. Music is blaring out. The words seem to tumble from the singer's mouth chaotically, and I feel as if my balance is going. Somehow I get tangled with a display of long bead necklaces. One strand round my coat button, another attached to my glasses chain. My hands aren't steady enough to undo the clasps, and the more I pull, the worse it gets. I start to think I'll be trapped here forever. Sweat collects along my spine. A girl comes towards me, not Katie, and a sudden sense of panic makes me rip the button from my coat. I leave my glasses, still attached to the beads, dangling sadly against the rack, and I back away onto the escalator, teetering at the edge of a step and gripping the handrail for support. There's a stripe of lipstick on my hand, suffocating my skin, and I rub my other hand over it, suppressing the ghost of a shudder. I've always hated how the stuff smudges. The department I arrive in is cookware and glass. The music bouncing off the hard surfaces is so loud I can hardly think. My specs are gone, and I search in my bag for the pale silk case. These second-best glasses feel funny on my face, and I have to keep adjusting them as I wander amongst the shelves of crockery. I can't think what I'm here for, and no inspiration comes. The cut glass vases and stoneware lasagna dishes give me no clues. I stand and read out the cleaning instructions on a metal wok. Remove stubborn residues with a sponge scourer or nylon cleaning pad only. Do not use metal scourers or any abrasive cleaners. A woman with orange fluffed-up hair gives me an odd look as she walks past. How long have I been here? I can't see the time. I might have been standing next to this shelf for hours. If I could just find a member of staff. I hear a shop assistant ask someone if they need help, but I can't see over the stands and I can't tell which side the voice is coming from. That is the last one, but my manager might give you a discount as it was on display. I rush one way, but there is no one there, so I hurry in the opposite direction. As I turn a corner, my bag catches something on the edge of a shelf. There is a smash. I freeze. Waterford Crystal, I read from the display. There's a couple of seconds' silence. No one comes. I start to move away. Oh! A woman in the dark blue shop uniform hurries to my side. You've broken this vase. Look, it's smashed to bits. You might have to pay for that, she says. It's £120. I begin to shake. £120? That's a fortune. I feel tears come into my eyes. I'll have to find my manager. Will you wait here? I nod and take out my purse. I have 2 £5 notes and 1 £20 as well as a bit of change. I can't work out what it all comes to, but I can see that it's not nearly enough. What should I do? Take her address? The woman says, coming back. She looks over the shelves at someone I can't see and then asks for my address. I can't remember it. She thinks I'm lying, but I'm not lying. I can't remember my address. I can't remember my address. It's something street, I say. Or something road. The woman looks at me with disbelief. Did you come here with someone? She asks. Who was it? We can page them. I open my mouth, but I can't remember that either. Okay, come with me, she says. She puts her hand on the back of my arm and guides me across the shop. I can't think where we're going. We walk through a department full of those beds for sitting on. Comfy, bouncy sitting beds. And I long to collapse into one. Finally, we come to a high desk. Can you remember who you came with now? She shouts, as though I'm deaf. I tell her I can't, and my stomach closes in on itself. You need to give me a name so I can page someone. She's still shouting. I can't think with her shouting. A man in an overall, wheeling a trolley of strangely mutilated-looking dolls, stops. Bloody hell, Grace, he says. What are you doing? We've got a vase smashed in glass, and this lady's lost, and I don't know who to page to come and get her, she says, not lowering her voice much. We're standing near a bank of TVs. The flickering screens, like 1,000 birds flapping their wings, make me feel dizzy. They make me think of Suki sliding the comb into her hair, and of the hedge next to our house, and of the woman in the foliage turning to run from Douglas's gaze.
"Just page her name and say she's here," the man says.
He turns to me.
"What's your name, love?"
For an instant, I think I've forgotten that too. But then it comes to me, and the next moment I hear the woman's voice pronounce it over the loudspeaker.
We wait.
I don't know how long. The woman goes off to talk to someone, and I can see those sitting beds in the distance. Surely no one would mind if I went for a rest. The first one I come to is a Prima Sudley sofa, large, in mushroom chenille. It's lovely and cosy. I sink into it. It's such a relief to be sitting that I'm in danger of nodding off. A sudden loud announcement wakes me up. Something about discounts on bath mats. I lever myself up from the sofa and stand for a minute. "Oh, Mum, where on earth have you been?" Helen says, coming out of a lift. "We've been looking for you everywhere." She takes my arm and we go back down in the lift. She will hold my arm, but won't catch my eye in any of the mirrored walls. The brown-tinted glass deepens her frown.
"She is cross with me. I worried her wandering off like that," she says.
Funny how things are reversed. Helen was always running away when she was a child. I'd find her school satchel half-packed with spare sweaters, bruised apples, and favourite shells. Or, if I missed that sign, I'd be forced to go looking for her across the heath. When Patrick was back from the Middle East, I left him to deal with it, not bothering to unpack the bag or chase off after her. She knew it, too. Knew I'd ignored her one repeated act of rebellion. And I paid for that when she was a teenager. Strange now to think that she's the child who stayed here, and my son Tom, who hated to spend a night away from home, has made his life in another country. We find Katie when the lift doors open, a security guard watching her paint each of her nails with a different coloured polish from the set of testers on a counter. He looks at me as I walk past and seems about to speak. I feel a sudden jolt of memory, though I can't quite place it. "I think I might have broken something," I say, as we walk through the doors into the street.
"No, Mum, your arm's just bruised. Remember?"
Chapter 4.
"I went to Elizabeth's house, see?" I say, holding my notes up for Carla. She doesn't look. I slap the bits of paper onto a little table and just miss knocking over my morning tea. "So, she wasn't in?"
"No, but there was no sign of her either."
Carla turns a page of the carer's folder. She's got some sort of flowery perfume on today, and it clouds up around her with each movement. "Was anyone else there?" she asks when she's finished writing. Her eyes widen for a moment, and I can tell there's some awful story coming. "I've heard of cases where young crack addicts move in with old people," she says. "They locked an old man in Boscombe in his room and asked all their crack addict friends to smash the house up and..." She pauses, waving one hand in the air. "Have orgies." I look at my notes. "But the house was very tidy," I say. Carla puts down the folder.
"Well, there was an old woman who was bound in a basement, and the robbers took everything and then tortured her and locked her in. And nobody knew she was there for days and days."
I watch Carla's face as she talks. Her eyebrows move up and down and the end of her nose turns pink. I wonder why she's so preoccupied with old people being locked in rooms.
Neither of these scenarios seems very likely, but I write them down anyway.
Perhaps I should go back to the house, I say.
No, she says, her tone changing. You mustn't go out. Write that down. I sit for a while after Carla's gone, staring into space, and then shuffle through my notes, making changes, putting Katie's name above the list of subjects she's studying at school. There's a letter from my son, and a photo of him with his wife and children. The photo is neatly labelled on the back. Tom, Britta, Anna, and Fred, in the Mecklenburg Lake District. It's not Tom's writing. Anna and Frederick look just like their mother. Evenly tan skin, treacle dark hair. Their smiles take up all their faces. Tom looks messy and blotchy in comparison. His smile cheekier, more knowing. The place looks very pretty, but I don't suppose I'll ever see it for myself. Tom stopped asking me to go and stay with them in Berlin years ago. The letter says that Anna has started at the gymnasium. Secondary school is in brackets next to this word, and I write it down on the paper with Katie's school subjects, reading it back to myself before finding another note. Elizabeth locked in room. Crack addicts in house. Bound and tortured in basement. I frown at my own writing. I must be going balmy. Crack addicts? The police would have been called. But I think, why not go to the house anyway? Check on Elizabeth. I wrap up warm, walk past the acacia tree, and knock at Elizabeth's door just in case. When there's no answer, I get out my pen. Still no Elizabeth at house. I step back and my head seems to empty itself. My stomach sinks, the muscles in my neck seize up. I can't think what I'm doing here, and I scrunch the bits of paper in my hand. Several fall to the floor. Crack addict, I read. Crack addict, Elizabeth locked in her room, bound in basement. Could I really have written that? It seems ridiculous. Elizabeth doesn't even have a basement. I peer through the letterbox, but I don't know what I'm looking for. I'm not entirely sure what crack is. How would I know if I saw it? The smell of cooking drifts into the air around me. A salty, meaty smell like frying bacon. It seems for a moment to be coming from inside the house, and I wonder if someone could be in there, cooking. What are you up to? A woman in one of those shiny coats you wear for rain comes out of the house next door. She puts a hand on the fence between us, her coat whispering loudly like an unruly child. Her other hand holds the lead of a bouncing dog. He claws at the wood of the fence and sniffs. It must be the bacon smell that's got him excited. I'm looking for Elizabeth, I say. Yes, you're a friend of hers, aren't you? Don't worry, you never remember me. She chuckles to herself, and I feel my face go hot with embarrassment. Visiting, are you? Think you'll get a surprise? Why? What's happened? Is Elizabeth all right? I haven't seen her, to be honest with you, but she's been having a clear-out by the looks of things. Her son's taken masses of boxes of stuff to his car. She pulls the dog back from the fence and grins. I stare at her. Peter's been removing things. And about time, don't you think? The state of that place. Full of rubbish. She waves a hand and then runs it through her short blonde hair. Her coat whispers something, but I can't catch the words. I've had to tell him about it often enough. It was getting to be a health hazard. I stop myself from rolling my eyes. What an exaggeration. Elizabeth's a bit untidy, that's all. It's the collecting, the china, the hoping for a fortune. But tidy people like to tell untidy people off. Peggy at the charity shop is like that, muttering to herself if you leave the price tags in a tangle.
So he's finally got round to doing something, and I'm glad. Cleared quite a lot of things out, far as I could tell.
What's he taken? I say. Elizabeth needs her things.
I can't know that, really, can I?
She lets the dog lead her towards the road. I follow on my side of the fence. Elizabeth sighed.
But you didn't see Elizabeth,
I say, my voice rising.
When was Peter getting rid of things? You didn't see her?
The dog strains at the lead and points his nose at the house opposite. I turn too, and yes, that's where the bacon smell is coming from. Not Elizabeth's. The woman opens her car door and shoos the dog in.
No, I didn't see Elizabeth. But then I never do, except when Peter takes her out. I must admit I wasn't sure about him before, but now he really seems to be looking after her properly. A good boy, isn't he?
I look away. I don't think Peter is good at all.
But she isn't in, and I haven't heard from her.
Must be with Peter, then.
I bite my lip. That doesn't sound right.
I've got his number if you want it, the woman says, struggling to make the dog sit. If you're worried, I'm sure he wouldn't mind you calling him.
Please. She slams the car door, making the dog whine, and goes back into her house. The dog and I stare at each other through the car window. The shaggy hair above his eyes gives him a puzzled frown as if he's thinking, "What am I doing in here when you're out there?" I have an urge to let him out and take him home. Could I do it before the woman comes back? No, she is already returning with a slip of paper. "Tell Peter I send my best," she says, as she hands it to me over the fence. "If you remember." I feel myself flush again and stand outside the house for a while after she's driven off, trying to think of something else to look for. Something to prove that I'm not a silly old woman. The slip of paper flutters about in my hand. I find I'm missing the dog. If only I could get my hands on a bloodhound. Then we could follow Elizabeth's scent trail. In the meantime, perhaps I should put a note through Elizabeth's door. Just to say I've been. Just to say I was looking for her. In case she comes back. Dad did that for Suki. None of us had seen her since the night of the fish and chips, and before a fortnight was up, we knew there was something wrong. Suki always came to us for at least one meal a week, and sometimes Frank would come too, bringing extra food or things he knew Ma would find it hard to get hold of, like soap or matches. He did lots of people favours, and seemed to be able to get extra things, including servicemen's rations, tiny tins of butter, cheese or jam. Ma would use those things first, so that Dad didn't see the tins. She didn't want to break the law, but she couldn't turn down extra food, not when it was so scarce. "And your dad can keep his conscience," Ma would say, "because it's not him as to queue for 2 hours and then make 3 meals a day out of a slice of ham and half a tomato." So I never said anything, and neither did Douglas, though he would narrow his eyes at Ma, exclaiming over the things and packing them away. There was no one in when Dad stopped at Suki's house on the way home from work, and no one in the week after. Ma went round a few mornings too and looked for Suki at the shops in town, but she never saw her. It didn't make any sense to us. One minute everything was fine, and the next she'd vanished. And Frank too. He was never at the house either, and Ma said he must have stopped in London. Dad tried the hospitals, thinking perhaps there'd been an accident, but neither Frank nor Suki had been brought in. I kept looking at the comb I'd bought, thinking of the matching one I'd given Suki. I felt there must be a way to find her, and the next time Dad went round to her house, I asked to go with him. I was surprised when he said I could. He always did his little jobs alone, and I started to regret my request as we walked the 10 streets to Suki's in silence. It was a blue-skied, windy day, and the smell of bonfires wafted over us, following the undulating roads. Once a man appeared at the crest of the hill, chasing his hat down towards us, but when I stopped it for him and handed it over, he looked at me strangely before throwing it up in the air and running after it again. Dad said he must be a bit touched and told me not to stare. It was the only time he spoke. We passed Douglas's old house on the way. Half of it had been blown off in an air raid 2 years before, but the inside wall was almost unscathed, and you could see a first-floor room above the heap of rubble. A clock still sat on the mantelpiece next to a statue of a bronze horse. And, as if to prove this hadn't been caused by bad luck, the mirror was unbroken. A lot of the wallpaper had come away, but some hung on, and the green and white flowers on their pink background seemed unfairly exposed to the daylight and the rain and the passers-by. I had been to see the house several times since Douglas moved in with us and had stared up at it, trying to imagine our lodger living there with his mother. At Suki's, we stood on the doorstep and Dad peered in through the windows of the four rooms. But there was no one about, and the sound of a dog barking madly somewhere in the distance made the place seem truly deserted. The dining room was full as ever of other people's furniture, with bookcases and lamps and empty plant pots piled against the inside of the glass, looking as though they were desperate to escape some terrible fate within. Most of Frank's house was used for storage. There was money in it, apparently, and his mother had made adjustments to each of the rooms when she'd run the business, moving walls and blocking up doors to create more space for the stuff of other people's lives. Frank once told me he'd had to sleep on a walled-off part of the landing until his parents' deaths, as his mother wouldn't give up the space for him to have a bedroom. The windows to the cellar had been bricked up, with just grills in the front for air. I tried to get a look through, but of course it was too dark to make anything out, so I went round to the yard behind where Frank kept his vans. The dog's bark was louder here, and the sound moved with the direction of the wind, so it seemed as if the animal was circling the house. Only one van stood on the frost-polished cobbles, and it didn't look like it had moved for a while. Gerard's removals had become Rorard's remove under the dust. I licked my finger and was uncovering the G from its cloak of grime when I heard a noise, a faint squealing somewhere above me, and looked up at the windows of the old stables. For a moment, I thought I saw fingers, the tips pressed against the glass, the skin flattened and white as they squeaked down towards the bottom of the pane. Coming closer, though, I saw the fat peach fringe of a standard lamp, resting flutteringly on the inside window ledge. And, knowing that the stables too were full of furniture, I guessed the squeaking had been mice nesting in amongst it. Even so, I started up the outside staircase, determined to get a better look. The door at the top was locked, or had something heavy resting against it. So I peered through its small window, squinting at the dark, dusty interior. And then I saw it, a face looking back at me from deep in the room. I slapped a hand to the glass, shouting before I realized what it was. My own reflection in a dressing table mirror which had been left on its side against a four-poster bed. Dad had come running at my shout, but drifted away again when he saw I was all right. And I was glad he didn't come up. Something else I could see through the grimy glass panes was a box of rations stamped British Army. I made my way back down the stairs, and in the quiet following my own voice, I listened again to the hoarse bark of the dog and looked over the fences of the nearby gardens to see if I could locate it. Dad had his hands in his pockets and was staring at the ground when I came round the house, and he didn't bother to comment on the absence of Frank or Suki. Of course, He had come and knocked before, had stood and waited before, had searched and peered, and then come home alone before. After a few moments, he got out a pencil and wrote a note on the back of an envelope. He always carried a little bundle in a rubber band. I didn't read it before he pushed it through the letterbox.
Hello?
It's a man's voice, thick and slurred. I'm on the sofa in my sitting room. The phone's just stopped ringing, and it's pressed against my ear. Hello? Who is it? I say.
Peter Markham. Who's this?
The words are clearer now. There's a whine to the voice. Peter Markham. I know that name. Is that Elizabeth's son? I ask.
My mother's name is Elizabeth. What do you want?
Oh, did I call you? I say.
Of course you phoned me.
He says something under his breath. Bloody something.
What is it you want?
Perhaps Elizabeth asked me to call you, I say.
Asked you? Why?
He says.
Where are you calling from?
I don't know why, I say. It must be important. I hold the receiver away from my ear and pause to think, gripping the phone until the plastic creaks. When did I see Elizabeth? And what did she ask me to call about? I can't remember. I rest the receiver on the arm of my chair and flick through the bits of paper on my lap, shuffling past the number for Peter Markham, a shopping list, and a recipe for gooseberry crumble. The drone of a car somewhere in the distance is like a fly buzzing under glass, like a memory flinging itself at the surface of my brain. I pick up the phone and hold the next note under the lamp. Where is Elizabeth? My stomach drops. She's missing, I say aloud. There's a crackling noise as Peter breathes hard into the mouthpiece.
Who is this?
He says, his voice sharp. My name's Maud. I'm a friend of Elizabeth's, I say. I had your number, and I was a bit worried about your mother.
It's the middle of the night, for fuck's sake.
I look at the clock above the gas fire. It says 3 o'clock. It's not daytime. I'm sorry, I say. I'm not so good with time now. Oh, dear, I am sorry. I leave you in peace, as long as Elizabeth is all right. The voice begins to sound muffled again, groggy.
I already spoke to your daughter.
Yes. Mama's all right.
I'm going to put down the phone now, okay?
There is a click at the end of the line and a long beeping noise. He's hung up. I quickly retrieve my pen. Elizabeth all right, says son. I write. Said fuck on phone, I add, though I'm not sure why it's significant. I replace the receiver carefully and find I'm thinking about Mrs. Winners. I haven't thought of her for years. She was the first person on our street to get a telephone. It was solid and beautiful, with a polished wooden base. She was very proud of it, and always stood by the window when phoning, so everyone could see, waving as you went by and pointing to the receiver. The shallowest pretext moved her to invite people in to use the phone, and I was amazed at the things she could find out through it. Not only news about her family, there were always stories about her cousin in Torquay and her sister in Doncaster, but things about the town, about the war. It seemed you could find anything out by telephone, and I wondered who it was she spoke to and how she remembered all the information. She rang lots of people for us when Suki disappeared, always telling my mother to keep her spirits up. And sometimes I've come home from school to find her in the kitchen with Ma, drinking tea and passing on crumbs of hope, and I would sit and listen too, refilling the teapot when Ma asked. I put my notes aside and make a pot of tea now. I don't do this very often, as tea is quite tricky. But this time, I remember to warm the pot and put in just 3 spoons of tea. As it's only for me. I carry it through to the sitting room and put it on the coffee table, curving my sleeve-covered arms around it for warmth. Steam rises from the spout and clings to the underside of my chin. The feeling is so particular, so familiar, and yet I can't think what it signifies. I try not to move, hoping the meaning will curl into my mind, but all I can think of is Dad putting something in the outside bin. I've brought the tea cozy which Elizabeth gave me into the sitting room, but I never usually use it. I'm afraid it's rather ugly, and bits of wool come off and get into the tea. It begins to feel like drinking a cloth pulp. Elizabeth's own tea cozy is similar, but she's somehow managed to stop the wool from shedding. "I've drunk the excess wool away," she told me. "It's probably expanding inside my internal organs." I make her a pot of tea whenever I'm at her house, and she reminds me how to do it if I get lost halfway. She says it's a luxury for her, as she's too weak to lift the teapot herself now. Her carers sometimes make a pot, but they never stay long enough for her to drink more than one cup, and she can't refill it after they've gone. And of course, Peter never gets her anything. He just comes in, dumps her shopping, and leaves. Elizabeth tells me he barely says a word to her, and spends most of the time in another room. The kitchen, or greenhouse. It's cruel when she's stuck in the house all day, and what she wants most is company. And then she said something recently. Something about him lying to her. There were things going missing, and then he lied. I wish I could remember the details. I pick up my notes again. Elizabeth, all right, says son. Somehow I don't feel reassured. I fetch the tea cozy and put it on, fitting it neatly over the pot. No wrinkles. I don't care about the shedding. It's nearly 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm not drinking the tea anyway. There was a lot of not eating and not drinking in the weeks after Suki disappeared, and a lot of not talking, too. Ma and Dad barely spoke in front of me, but I overheard bits of their conversation when they thought I was out of earshot. The word police came up a lot. One Sunday we were sitting at the kitchen table, not eating lunch and not looking at each other, the light beginning to dim outside when Dad got up.
"Come on," he said. "We'll go and ask the neighbours."
He swung his jacket onto his back and held the kitchen door open for me. I remember looking at Ma still sitting at the table. She didn't turn to watch us go. She'd already spoken to Suki's next-door neighbour, a woman who used the same greengrocer as us, but all she'd had to say was that there were some funny types around nowadays.
"You never know. Someone might know something," Dad said as we jogged along towards Suki's road.
The laundry had its doors open, and there was something almost heady and luxurious about the scent of the soap. But it was a false smell, and somehow it made Suki seem further away. We began at the house next to Frank's yard. Dad knocked on the door, and it opened quickly, as if the man had been standing behind it. A head poked out.
"Yeah."
The head was shaggy, and a bad smell came from the dark corridor, souring the scent of the laundry. Dad cleared his throat.
"I was hoping you might... I wanted to ask..."
He paused, took a breath. Moss was growing along the brick by the doorframe, and I curled my fingernails into its soft dampness.
"I'm looking for Susan Palmer. I mean..."
Dad shook his head.
"Susan Gerard. She lives at number 23. Have you seen her?" "Never seen her."
The head shook its unwashed hair.
"What, gone missing, has she?"
Dad nodded.
"Was it to you?"
She's my daughter, Dad said.
Oh, right. Well, Frank's at 23, and she's all right if she's with him, I should think.
He's not there either.
There you are, then, taking her off somewhere.
A smile appeared under the hair. There were gaps in the teeth, and a tongue was rubbed into each space. Dad cleared his throat again.
She would have told us. I mean, they're married, he said. She would have said if she were going off with him.
Oh, they're married.
He sounded disappointed.
Then I couldn't speculate, I'm afraid.
We tried the next house along. While Dad knocked, I leant over the string that had replaced the railings and looked at the rubbish that had collected below street level. The old man at that address hadn't seen Suki either, but he knew Frank.
Lots of women going off now, he said. Seen it in the papers. Don't seem to like it when their husbands come home, and so they're off to London or some other ungodly place. Frank's a good un. She should be happy with him. He moved my sister down from Coventry, didn't ask a penny. Said he had another job and could put her things in with it. My sister wouldn't have been one to leave her husband, if she'd ever had one. That much I can tell you.
Dad carried on down the street. I stood and watched him make his way to the end of the road. The sky was grey and the red of the bricks dulled, but it wasn't cold.
No one's seen anything, Dad said, coming back to me. Or they're not saying if they have. Careless talk and all that. You'd think the war was still on. Shall we go home?
I thought about the dress pattern that Suki had started for me. I could picture it spread out on my bedroom floor. I couldn't help thinking that she would walk in any minute and pick up the scissors. I hadn't touched it since she'd cut out the sleeves, and I couldn't bear the idea of going back to look at it. "Let me knock at one," I said, and stepped up to a thickly painted door. The blue paint had run and then set in drips as if it were rain, and I traced the bumps as I waited for an answer. "I'm looking for my sister Suki," I blurted out when the door opened. "She lived just down there. I don't know what's happened to her. She didn't say she was moving away, and I can't find her now. There's no one at her house. Have you seen her? She's got a comb like this." I was close to crying. I felt embarrassed and childish and wished I hadn't knocked on the door at all. The woman, wearing a hairnet and standing just inside the door frame, looked quickly along the street. "How many doors you've knocked on, then?" she asked. "I don't know. Maybe 10. No one's seen her." I breathed against the tears. The woman shot another look towards Suki's house.
"What number was your sister at?"
23. She nodded.
"No, they wouldn't have said probably. Look, I don't know where they went. I wasn't sure they'd gone, to be honest. But they had some trouble, I know that much. All sorts in and out of that house. And one night she runs out screaming."
She paused to let me gasp.
"But it was quiet the next day, and I sees her in the street right as rain, so..."
"When was that?"
Dad said, coming to stand behind me. The woman looked over my shoulder at him.
"Few weeks ago? Not sure. Seen him carrying a case since. Thought I saw her too, but like I say, can't be sure. And before you ask, no, I don't know where they were going."
Dad was quiet for a bit after the door had closed, and then he turned to me.
"Right," he said. "You can do the talking from now on, seeing as how you got that woman to tell you something."
He pushed me forwards to the house at the corner.
"Yes?"
A man opened the door and stood with his shirt open. Its creases were sharp, and it gave off the warm smell of freshly ironed cotton. "I'm looking for my sister," I said. "She lives at that house." I pointed a finger, my arm shaking. "But she's not there now. I thought she might have left a forwarding address or something." The man stepped over the threshold and leant over to look at Frank and Suki's front door, as if he needed reminding that there was a house there at all.
Sister? Oh. Dark hair? No, I can't say that I know where she's gone. Had a bit of a row, though, I think. I remember something of the kind, anyway. Missing her, are you? I'm sure she'll be back. Though, now I think about it, it's been weeks since I saw Frank.
Do you know Frank?
We've had a bit of a drink of an evening. Done me a couple of good turns as Frank.
That made two people Frank had helped. I tried the house opposite Suki's next. The front door had frosted glass with a net curtain behind it. A woman in a very stiff-looking housecoat came to the door. I asked her if she had seen Suki.
"Can't say I remember," she said, fiddling with the lace collar under her chin.
Her voice was rich and had a dry rasp to it which caught at my nerves.
"I'm not one of these busybodies who watches everyone."
"But someone told me she'd run into the street screaming," I said.
"Did they? Did they really?"
The woman looked accusingly at every house along the road, as if she was trying to find out who had given the game away. Then she shook her head very firmly.
"I never heard anything. Not a hint. People don't go about screaming in the street."
"That's funny. You see, we've had accounts that she came out." I looked into the woman's face, the implacable lines of it, and sighed.
"Accounts, eh? I'm sure. And I bet they don't know the half of it either. Like I say, I never heard anything, but I know your sister was up to something. I know it. Sorry if it pains you." "She had men round."
"Men?"
"Yes. One at least. Young one. Here all the time he was. Told me some nonsense about him being her parents' lodger, but I knew."
"Douglas, you mean?"
"A name like that, yes."
"Oh, but that's true. He is our lodger."
"Is he now? Is he? Well, that's as maybe."
I thought she was going to say more, but she just nodded at me until I stepped down to the pavement. I moved on one. The next door was answered by a couple. They knew Suki a bit, had invited her and Frank in a few times, but never had an invitation back. They didn't seem to mind, though. "Frank gave my Don a bit of work when he came out of the army," the wife said. "So kind of him. Really kept us going, that did." "Someone else said they'd seen Frank leaving with a suitcase," I said.
"Yes. Well, since Don got a job at Muckley's, we don't have very much to do with him, as I said. Not that we aren't grateful for the work he did put Don's way."
I thanked them and started to walk back towards Dad, thinking that made three favours. "Hey, love." A young woman came out of the stiff house-coated lady's door, wrapping a long mackintosh around her thin frame. I stopped and waited for her.
"I heard the screaming," the woman said. "Sorry about my aunt. She's got a dread of the unrespectable. But look, it's not what you think. It can't have been Frank that your sister was afraid of."
"Then who?"
"I don't know. But I saw Frank come home after that. So you see, it couldn't have been him."
I looked up at her and shivered. Had someone else been in the house that night?
"I saw them with suitcases too."
"Both of them?"
"Well, Frank, anyway. A few weeks ago, that was. I know Suki didn't like what was going on, and..."
"How do you mean?"
I asked. "Child, your family's obviously the law-abiding sort."
She looked over at Dad as she said this. He had picked up someone's lost glove and was arranging it over a railing at the end of the road.
"But Frank, he isn't. Suki didn't like his business dealings."
She emphasized the words with a raise of her eyebrows.
"You never know. Perhaps they've gone away to make a fresh start."
"But she hasn't contacted us for weeks." "She wouldn't do that. She'd tell us where she was if she could. My dad thinks she's been kidnapped or killed or something. He won't say it, but that's what he thinks."
"It is odd.
She's a real family girl, isn't she? Talks about you a lot, anyway.
She smiled sadly at me.
Don't know what else to say. Have you checked the hospitals?
When you heard her screaming, was that the same night they left?
The woman frowned and twisted the material of her Macintosh in her hands.
Don't think so.
Can't be certain.
Time gets a bit mixed up sometimes, doesn't it? I mean, the way I remember it, Frank went off with a case and came back the same night. But that doesn't seem to fit, does it?
And you're sure you haven't seen them since?
Definite. There were a couple of men hanging around outside last week, but neither one was Frank.
Probably police, knowing him.
I nodded, looking over at the house. I felt something should be making sense by now.
The woman squeezed my shoulder and slipped away, and I stood wondering when Suki had spoken to her about me.
Well, Dad said when I got near him. I shrugged.
She did come out screaming. That woman said to check the hospitals.
He nodded, though I knew he'd done that already, and we started walking.
You think she's been kidnapped or something, don't you?
It's the or something I'm worried about, Poppet. She should never have married that man. I knew he was the wrong sort.
I didn't know what to say, so we walked in silence for a few minutes. I tried to remember anything else that might be helpful. That woman I spoke to last said Frank had business dealings. I tried to replicate the emphasis the woman had given the words, and Dad's face creased. I thought he was going to cry and was amazed at the power of the words, but as we got to the end of the street, I saw he was laughing.
Oh, Maud, what's that supposed to mean? He asked, waggling his eyebrows in the way I had.
I don't know, I answered, allowing myself to smile. I thought you would know.
You said something about Elizabeth's son, Helen says.
We are in her dining room, and she's crouching down, getting out placemats for the table. There are people coming for lunch, but I can't remember who or why.
Katie rests against the doorpost, a silly smile on her face. She taps at one of these tiny phones.
Did I?
Yes. Peter's his name.
Helen's voice is muffled by the cupboard she has her head in.
I think I spoke to him, I say, searching through my notes.
Yes, I did too. And it turns out Elizabeth's not missing, is she?
I flick through the paper.
That's what you said, Mum.
Helen pulls her head out of the cupboard to look at me.
I said he said she was all right. That's good news then, isn't it?
She gets up and puts a pile of mats on the table. I'm still frowning over my writing.
I don't know, I say. He swore at me.
Helen bangs the cupboard door shut, and the plates on the dresser rattle. The noise makes me swell with irritation for a moment. She puts hand on a plate to silence it, and then turns to lay the tablecloth out.
She's a bit haphazard about it and can't seem to get it even.
You could help, you know, she says to Katie.
My granddaughter nods and shifts a foot from the door, but she doesn't make it any further. She doesn't take her eyes from the phone. He was quite angry, I say. Helen, if a friend of mine called you and said they were worried about me, what would you say?
I'd say you should be worried because she's quite dotty.
Helen, okay, okay.
She drops the edge of the tablecloth.
I'd say thank you for your concern, but there's nothing to worry about. The men in white coats are coming for her soon.
I sigh. Fine. I wouldn't say the last bit. She picks up the tablecloth again, pulls it towards her.
But you wouldn't get angry.
No. She walks round to pull the other side, sighing in Katie's direction.
You see, Helen, I don't trust him. Oh, Mum. Surely only someone with a guilty conscience. You called him in the middle of the night.
He was bad-tempered, and no wonder.
That doesn't mean he lied or that he's done his mother in.
I know. But I think he's hiding something.
Right. Katie, go and hang about somewhere else.
She opens a drawer and rakes through it.
Mum, put these out, would you?
She hands me a bundle of knives and forks.
I put them down in the centre of the table and follow her to the kitchen. There's a smell of rosemary and mint, and I hope we're having lamb. But knowing my daughter, it's as likely to be some sort of tafu or torfo business.
Mum, she says, turning round and bumping into me.
Stay in there and set the table, will you?
Sorry.
I go back to the dining room and stand still for a minute. I can't think what I'm supposed to be doing, but I can hear someone in another room.
Katie, I've told her 100 times, a voice says, and I can't take her there.
Peter was adamant. I just wish she'd forget about it. There's a murmuring answer, and then,
oh, very bloody funny.
I follow the noise. Helen is in the kitchen.
Back again? She says. I asked you to help me.
Have you got a bit of paper?
She puts out a hand and I give her a blue square. She fishes in a drawer for a pen, writes, set the table, and hands the square back to me.
Give me the rest of the notes, she says. I'll put them somewhere safe.
Back in the dining room, I begin to arrange things on the table. Mats spaced evenly, spoons above. I pick up a knife and fork and stand thinking for a minute.
I can't remember which side they go. Fork right or fork left? I lay them down where I think they should be, but for the next place along I change my mind. I take another knife and fork. Looking at my hands, I try mimicking the action of cutting up food. Do they look right where they are, or should I swap them over? I try swapping. They look the same. When Helen comes in, I'm still examining my hands, looking at the wrinkles on the knuckles, the papery skin, the brown spots.
Have you finished, Mum? Helen asks.
What are you doing?
I don't look up. It's such a little thing, knowing where to put cutlery. But I feel like I've failed an important test. A little piece of me is gone.
It looks very nice, she says,
her voice too bright. She walks round the table and I watch her out of the corner of my eye. I see her look at me. I see her hesitate and then quickly swap the knife and fork. She says nothing. Doesn't point out my mistake.
I don't want to set the table again, I say.
Chapter 5.
It's dark out here, but there's a glimmer of grey light somewhere, low in the sky. It will be day soon, and I must finish this. A mist of rain clings to my hair, to my arms and thighs. It makes me shiver, but thankfully doesn't disturb the soil. That stays in its perimeter pile. I have to lean right in to dig now. A long breath pulled deep into my lungs leaves me with the raw, wet taste of the bruised earth. My knees shift, nestled in the sodden ground, and the fabric of my trousers slowly draws moisture up my legs. Soil is caked on my hands and driven into my fingernails to the point of pain. Somewhere, the other half of the compact hides. In front of me is a hole that I've been digging in the middle of the green garden carpet. And suddenly I can't think what I'm doing here, what it is I'm looking for. For a moment,
I'm too frightened to move, not knowing what I might do next. It could be anything. I might tear the flowers from their beds or chop down the trees, fill my mouth with leaves, or bury myself for Helen to dig up again. Panic starts to seep from my stomach and my shoulder blades shudder together. The cold has got into my joints and I ache with it. Slowly, I brush what dirt I can from my hands and am wiping them on the green carpet. The garden carpet, not moss, the other thing. I pull myself steadily upright. And still I have the urge to go on digging, to search for something in the ground. But what can be here in my own garden? Unless it's something I've planted. Have I put something here and forgotten? I sway on my feet, the grey, shadowless garden shimmering around me. But then a spark of pale gold drops over the trees in the distance. Dawn plummeting into the day. I press a foot against a mound of soil and work it into the hole, trampling the newly flat earth. It's dawn, and I'm out in the garden. And how lovely, really. How nice to get some fresh air and watch the sun coming up. I'm shaking still as I walk back to the house, but there's no need. I just came out to see the dawn and have a bit of air and some exercise. Nothing to worry about. And now I'll go and do something I haven't done for ages. I'll have a bath. Inside, I run the taps, adding some sort of gloopy, flowery liquid, something Helen must have bought for me. I peel my trousers from my knees, the skin greyish after its dawn encounter with the wet earth, and take off the silky nightdress I have on top. I never sleep in this. I must have put it on especially. I wish I knew why. Such a stupid thing to wear. I squeeze the fabric in my fist, listening to the muffled fizz of bubbles forming in the bath. No, I think. Perhaps it was a treat. A lovely silk nightie for a lovely golden morning. And why not? I drop it onto the floor and clamber carefully into the bath. I like being in the water. Old people aren't supposed to have baths. We're meant to shower while sitting on a little stool. But you can't think when you're having to balance on a bit of plastic with water gushing over your head. And I need to think. My hands tremble as I reach for the cake. The slippery washing cake. But really, I don't know why. I'm having a lovely time. And anyway, I won't mind so much once this dirt has come away. My mouth has that stale, grimy taste that makes me think of the time I spent ill in bed as a child, and I rub the edge of the washing cake against my lips. It's wonderful getting clean again after you've been working hard. I wish I could remember what I was supposed to have been working hard at. When I'm clean and dry, I rummage in the wardrobe for one of Patrick's old shirts. Helen wanted to take them all to wear when she's gardening, but I kept a few. Some of them are very good. He had them specially made for him while he was working in Kuwait, and the material is soft and thick. It's nice to be able to put one on. A reminder. A comfort. I can almost convince myself they still smell of him, though of course they've been washed many times between his death and now. This shirt is white, with dove-grey stripes. The cotton cold at first. Too big for me, but that's what's nice.